My name is Jan Cahoon. I am 37 years old, and today is April 11th, 2009 in Salt Lake City, and I am the niece of my Uncle Harvey.
And I'm Harvey Cahoon. I'm 63. Today's April the 11th, 2009. We're here in Salt Lake City, and Jan, my niece, is interviewing me.
We're going to focus on learning more about our family's relationship and history with Interstate Brick. Uncle Harvey, can you please tell me the history of Interstate Brick, how it began, how were the Cahoons involved, and what was its original name?
The guy that started the company was named John P. Cahoon, John Pulaski Cahoon. And that's my middle name, too, Harvey P. Pulaski Cahoon. He was my great-grandfather. And he made brick when he lived in Murray in the late 1800s for several years. But then when he moved to the site on 33rd South and 11th East and started the Salt Lake Pressed Brick Company, and I think it was 1891. He was the son of Andrew Cahoon and the grandson of Reynolds Cahoon, Reynolds being the first Cahoon that joined the Mormon Church, and he and his son Andrew came out to Utah as pioneers. So John was a grandson of the original Cahoon, LDS Cahoon. So John started the brick company as a continuation of other, you know, businesses he had done, and built the brick plant on 33rd South, which has long since has been torn down in the late 70s, and the only thing that's still there is a smokestack from the original plant and a plaque on the Brickyard Plaza. That's all that's left there. The company then moved to West Jordan in around, you know, early 70s, and that's where they operate now.
How did they make brick back then?
Well, bricks have been made for, I'd say centuries, but thousands of years, basically the same way. People take clay, get it wet, squish it around, make it kind of soft, and then throw it in a mold and form it in a rectangular shape, you know.
A wooden mold.
Yeah, in a wooden mold, and scrape it off and then dump it out on a board and put it out in the sun to dry. That's how original bricks were made in Moses' time, Babylonian time, and even in the colonial time in the United States, and even here. People back then knew how to make bricks. It was like knowing how to drive a car. It was one of those things that was not that unusual to know how to do. Well, naturally, any thing like that can become industrialized, and John was an entrepreneur, and he built a brick business around that skill. And even though there were other brick companies back then, lots of little ones, he started the Salt Lake Press Brick Company. But in terms of making bricks, I mean, it just obviously it isn't the most efficient way to do it by hand. So what he did was adopt some of the technology that had been developed about that time with a machine called a brick press. And a brick press has like a lever. I don't know. It's hard to describe to you. It's kind of lever arms that when they pull together, they put tremendous pressure, mechanical pressure. It's not hydraulic. It's not electronic. It's totally driven by mechanical means. It rams a rectangular plug into a mold that's shaped like a brick. And that pressure on that damp clay forms a very dense, hard brick in a press. And then the mold pops out, and it pops the brick out, and it comes off. And then you pick the brick off and put them through a dryer. And then after the brick are dry, then you put them through the kiln. And the reason they called it the Salt Lake Pressed Brick Company, because they didn't make them by hand anymore. They made them with presses. And the press, the most common, or probably the most famous press then, and the most successful press, was a mechanical toggle press by the Boyd, B-O-Y-D, Boyd Press Company. I looked them up the other day. They still are in existence, but the machines that press brick look really like 1920s looking, because they're all mechanical, big, heavy steel arms, you know, it's amazing. Anyway, and John P's son, John Cahoon, his son, his original name was John Cahoon. But he was so fascinated as a boy at these presses that he changed his name to John Boyd Cahoon. And that's how the Boyd name got in our family. And then so John Boyd had a son, John Boyd Jr., and he has a son, John Boyd III. That's my cousin. Okay, so that's how they pressed brick. Now, after that, around the same time, but a little bit later, the extrusion method came into existence, where you put kind of damp clay in a machine that mixes it together and then squeezes it out of a die in a continuous stream, kind of like toothpaste coming out of a tube, but it's all, you know, never stops. It goes continuously. And then you pull piano wires through that column to make the individual bricks. That's how almost all bricks in the United States, around the world, are made. Well, I shouldn't say around the world. There's some third world countries where they still make them with wooden molds and, you know, the old-fashioned way. But that's how bricks are made, and that's why it's called the Salt Lake Pressed Brick Company.
Can you tell me a little bit about where the clay came from?
There are probably two important distinctions to make about clay. One is that most of the clay that built the Salt Lake Pressed Brick Company was common clay. It occurs at the surface. You know, it's just out in the valley, the Salt Lake Valley. There were places where there was clay. It would have been at the bottom of Lake Bonneville, you know, maybe geologically only 15, 20,000 years old. Not, you know, very young geologically. That clay was what the common brick were made out of, and it fired to a kind of a yellow color, okay? Later, when they needed tougher bricks, they used shale, and that would come for the brickyard. Most of it came from out by Utah Lake, a pit called the Powell Pit, and that's right in the same place that Saratoga Springs is today, and in another place 5 miles west of Fairfield out in Utah County, and that we used to call it the 5 Mile Pass Clay Pit. The 5 Mile Pass was an underground mine where they tunneled underground with you know, like regular miners digging the clay out. Those are probably the two main sources of clay, shale, other than the common clay. Now, when the Salt Lake Press Brick Company got going, most of the brick they made, by far, by just grundles, the biggest amount of brick they made were common brick, made with this common clay. They weren't really super durable. If you leave them out and let them get wet and freeze and thaw, they're going to break down. But that didn't matter, because all of these brick were used on the inside of the walls of buildings. So if you go to downtown Salt Lake City or any other major city, inside the walls of the building, the brick are common brick, because they just needed something hard and substantial to support the building. So this is before steel and concrete became a common way to build. Now, so the interior of the walls could be common brick. I mean, Dad used to joke and tell me that they didn't even use cement. In fact, they got so sloppy sometimes they just dump them in with wheelbarrows. You know, but the interior of that wall could be common brick, and used millions and millions of brick on not very big buildings. Face brick. Made with shale, were much tougher, much harder, and when you use those, you could put on the exterior of the building. They look really good. The color's really deep and vibrant and all that, and they're super tough. And so, you know, face brick were less common. The clay was mined at the brickyard site on 11th East. And 33rd South. And once they dug it all out, then they went east of there, up past the Villa Theater, under Highland Drive with a little electric trolley train, and they dug out all of the area that's now called Mount Air Acres. They dug it completely all out, and so that a subdivision is there now. Then when that got depleted, then the next place they went was up across the street just to the west of Olympus High School. There's a whole subdivision there where there was a clay pit, and they dug it all out, and then, you know, some of it got backfilled a little bit, but now there's houses there. So that's where the common clay came from. Excuse me. So common clay, shale, that's the two main sources.
And how do they cook the brick?
Well, when you bake a brick, you don't do it like you do in your kitchen at home, you know. But it's the same sort of idea. It's just that you do it in a kiln, and it's common in our industry to say that we fire the brick. We don't burn them or bake them because, you know, if you were burning them, it would be like burning wood. You know, it's consumed. Well, they're not consumed. They're fired. And typically the fuel back then was coal. Well, you know, a long time ago it was straw and wood, but industrially it was based on coal. Then when natural gas was discovered over in Wyoming, then natural gas became the fuel. The plant at 33rd and 11th East, when I grew up, we'd go down there with my dad, Gary, your dad, Gary and I would go down there with dad, your grandpa, and a plant called Plant B was still there. And it was just an old, huge. I mean, I'll bet it was 600-700 feet long, old wooden beams, you know, I mean, just old industrial kind of a building. But it was no longer used at all, and that was where the common brick were made. Just north of there was the house, the yellow brick house where Grandpa Cahoon, Grandpa John B. Cahoon, had a house, and in that house, your Grandpa Harold was born. That little house, the only thing that's left of it now is the door from that house is on the door of Grandma Cahoon, Grandma Priscilla's house down in St. George, down in Washington, Utah.
And where was that old yellow house?
Just north of the old Plant B at the Brickyard.
Okay.
Okay. Uncle George and Aunt Viola lived there for a while, but that's, it's all gone now. Because the only thing that's left is that chimney. One of the kilns, so you got to bake brick in a kiln, okay? We said you fire them. Okay, well, one of the kilns that they had that I remember as a kid, it wasn't being used anymore, was called a Hoffman kiln. It was invented in Germany in, the late 1800s or so. And it was like a racetrack. It is oblong, you know, not rectangular, but roundish oblong. And it was maybe 200 feet long and maybe 100 feet wide, and inside this chamber, which was continuous all the way around inside that brick kiln, was a hollow area where they would put the bricks in. They would seal up the doors, and then where you brought the bricks in all by hand, and then they would start a fire in it and provide the fuel through the top, through the roof, through ports in the roof, down into that kiln. And once it got really hot in just one area, they would pull the heat around that kiln over time so that the hottest part of the kiln would gradually move around that kind of racetrack, around that Hoffman kiln. So the brick that were going to be fired were put in ahead of that, and then the door sealed up. Then the fire would get to there, and the ones behind there would gradually cool off. The advantage of the Hoffman was that the cooling brick provided some of the heat to heat up the brick that were getting hotter. So it was a continuous process and was efficient, relatively efficient. So, but that kiln was out of use when I was there, and it was torn down along with some of the beehive kilns when they built the tunnel kiln. And a tunnel kiln is basically a long refractory tunnel with a little kind of railroad cars with refractory tops on them that you'd stack the brick on, and then you have a long string of those you push down maybe 300-400 foot long tunnel, and as they go down through from the sides, the gas is turned in and it gets hot, and the brick over just a few days period of time are heated and cooled and they're fired.
Didn't you say that was Grandpa's idea to kind of move forward with the technology?
I'll come to that.
Okay.
One other thing I want to tell you about the kilns. One of the kilns, you know, these periodic kilns are energy inefficient, like the beehive kilns. Another one they had was called a field kiln. And the reason I want to tell you about that is because it affects, you know, your dad and I used to remember that. A field kiln was essentially just two big walls, maybe 100 feet long and 30 feet high, out in the field. And between them was an empty space. And you would fill that empty space in a big rectangular cube of brick stacked loosely. You'd seal off the ends, and then along those walls, there were ports underneath where you could put the fuel in. Well, when I was a kid, they were using natural gas. And they just, it was very simple. They just had a pipe down the side of that kiln, and every 8 feet or so, there was a valve, like a water faucet valve, going out of a pipe, and out on the end of that pipe was a little cap, and they drilled a hole in the cap, and that was the burner. It was not exotic at all. You stuck that burner in the side of the port into the kiln and lit it. Well, after, you know, days, it would finally get so hot inside the kiln that it'd be glowing yellow or glowing, you know, getting hotter and hotter. And when it got to that point, then a harmonic behavior started in that kiln. I've got a physics degree. I don't know exactly how this works, but I know it worked because I saw it myself. The gas would come out of those pipes continuously, all the time, never stopped. The whole time it was going, they were coming out. But when it got hot enough, then the fire, it would catch fire in a period, in a pulsing way. So every 10 seconds or so, it goes, and then it go, ooh, this big whoomp sound when it like burned all of a sudden. I don't know why it did that, how it did that. But our house where Gary and I grew up, your dad, was, oh, goodness, a couple of miles from the brickyard. And at night, in our bunk bed, we could hear that whoom, whoom, at night. Conditions had to be good, but, you know, you could hear those kilns going. So that was another way they fired the brick.
Did you want to talk about the different names of the kilns at the brickyard?
Well, the main ones were the beehives, the field kiln, the Hoffman kiln, and then, you know, ultimately the tunnel kiln.
Okay. And then what happened with the family's involvement with Interstate Brick?
Okay. John Pulaski Cahoon, my great-grandfather, was a very aggressive entrepreneur. He had businesses all over the Salt Lake area. He had power plant up Mill Creek Canyon. He was a member of the Cahoon Miller Company. I've got a milk can from the Cahoon Miller Company. I don't even know what they did for business, but he was a very entrepreneurial guy. Lots of businesses. In the early part of the Great Depression, you know, I think in the early 30s, the company got in trouble. I think it was partly the Depression and, you know, building being way down, but it was also that common brick were going out of style. And I say style, the technology of building with steel and concrete was coming on strong. And so you didn't use so many common brick anymore because the buildings were held up by steel and concrete, not by the bricks. They weren't structural anymore. So the market for common brick went down the toilet, and the Depression added to that, and the company went into receivership in the early 30s. And I guess the creditors, you know, all banded together, and they put together some kind of a deal where the company was rejuvenated or reborn as the Interstate Brick Company. And that's when the logo of the little brick man was born. That came, you know, that was the successor to the Salt Lake Press Brick Company. The Walker Bank was involved in that process. I'm not sure exactly how much. But so as of that time, then the family lost the control of the company. The family still owned some stock in the company, but no longer were they the majority stockholder. Well, after that, you know, the war came. John P.'s sons, Chester and John B. Cahoon, the Boyd, they ran the company. And after the war, you know, business came back, the baby boomers, the housing, but man, you know, things got way, way better. And they shifted to making face brick instead of common brick. Then in the late 60s, I don't know, it would have been about the mid 60s, Grandpa John B., my grandpa, retired, and my dad, Harold P. Pulaski Cahoon, he took over. And he pushed very hard with Grandpa John to get these tunnel kilns built that were much more efficient, much more productive, but it was a battle. You know, it was the old Depression mentality versus my dad, who had got a PhD in ceramic engineering, was very forward thinking. It was a hard time getting that to happen. Anyway, so the company grew there on 33rd South and 11th East. They over time, they gradually got completely surrounded by suburbia. I mean, there's just houses all the way around them. There's no place to grow. Plus, there's always friction between a big industrial operation and houses. So Dad figured that the company needed to move, and he chose West Jordan as the place to move to. And he knew that the company, they just didn't have the wherewithal in terms of taking on a lot of additional debt to be able to finance going out to West Jordan and building a whole new plant from scratch. So he worked out with Mr. B.Z. Kassler, who was the chairman of Mountain Fuel Supply, for the company to be sold completely to Mountain Fuel. So Mountain Fuel took all the stock, traded the Mountain Fuel stock for the Interstate Brick stock. So people who owned Interstate Brick got Mountain Fuel stock, but then the company or the family ceased ownership of the company because it really, as an entity, it existed, but as a, you know, separate, it was a division of Mountain Fuel Supply. In the early 80s or so, the company expanded aggressively. My dad was never bashful about pushing. He wasn't bashful about pushing for stuff. And he made some big expansions about them. And right then, wham, inflation went crazy. Interest rates went nuts. Housing went down. I mean, we talked today about, you know, this being the worst time since World War II, and everybody compares it back to, you know, it's the worst unemployment since the 80s. Well, it was terrible then. And because of that, you know, things got kind of tight at the Brickyard. Dad, I think it was 1986 or so, I'm not sure about the exact date, he retired. I became the president. And you know, and it was not easy. I mean, it was a tough time. Well, at any rate, we tried to get things turned around, and I think did a pretty good job. But without being mean-spirited about it or, you know, throwing rocks at anybody, Mountain Fuel, which had a new president, and I didn't get along. We didn't see eye to eye on how the Brickyard ought to be run. And so ultimately they asked me to resign, which I did. They ran the company for a few years and then finally sold it when they figured out that they didn't know much better how to run it than we'd been doing. And they sold it to a company called Pacific Coast Supply in California. I tell you, it was very tough leaving Interstate Brick. When I left there, I'm sitting in my dad's old office. I got John P., Chester, John B., and my dad Harold on the wall in pictures, and I'm the last Cahoon there. That was a very difficult time and not a very pleasant experience.
I might just want to ask you, not only were you an employee at Interstate Brick with Grandpa and your grandfather and great-grandfather, but my dad, Gary, and my uncle, Brad, worked there.
That's right. But Bradley's still involved in the brick industry. He's up in Washington State working in the brick industry. And I continued in the brick industry and worked at a tile plant and that sort of thing. And, you know, I have lots of good memories about my experience and involvement there. But leaving Interstate was not a very pleasant experience. As you can imagine, after being in the family for several, sort of in the family for several generations, although really the Depression was the start of it really going away. And then when they sold it all out, well, we're in effect just employees.
I will say that I remember being not brainwashed, but it was the thing as a little kid to think brick. You know, brick is the best kind of house, the best kind of facade
That's
you can have. And I'm still biased, so.
Me too.
I want to ask you what you have learned about your family and its involvement at Interstate Brick.
Well, I mean, as you can tell, as we've talked here, no business is without its ups and downs. And all people have strengths and weaknesses. And working at the Brickyard inevitably showed the character of the people that worked there. From a little reading, some things my dad wrote, and what I know personally, it's easy to think that my grandpa, John Boyd, and Harold, my dad, were pretty gruff sometimes. They were very hardworking. They were very committed to the brick company. I mean, they were practically married to it. I mean, Dad and Grandpa never, ever stopped thinking about the brick company. They were so committed to it. But they had other sides, too. Grandpa John Boyd was a generous man that did really good things for people that were rarely recognized. And he didn't seek recognition. It's very... I don't say private, but he was not at all ostentatious. Other people would drive Lincoln Continentals. Grandpa drove a Chevrolet. That was the kind of guy he was. Our bishop, where I grew up at the time, was Paul Pearson. And his company was the Pearson Hardware Company in Sugar House.
And you said that was...
That was right next to the Southeast Theater. And I'm not sure that's there either, but it's just north of the library in Sugar House.
Okay.
Bishop Pearson revered my grandpa, John Boyd. Grandpa had evidently given Paul some money at a time when the hardware business was in trouble, and it saved him. I don't know what the details were, never heard any nitty-gritty about it, but Bishop Pearson, who was naturally emotional anyway, could never talk about our family at church or any time without weeping. It always happened. And when Grandpa, and that was because of my grandpa, when Grandpa John came to my missionary farewell, which was one of the few times he came, because he wasn't a really religious guy in his later life. You know, not very outwardly religious. Bishop Pearson was beside himself. I mean, he was so, you know, we called him a great Christian. And I think that's really true. Grandpa John evidently did many, many such good unseen deeds. My dad, too, your Grandpa Harold, was also kind of gruff on the outside sometimes. But an example of that is one Sunday morning, Gary, your dad, and I went with him down to the brickyard. We'd always go with him. We'd always ride in the front seat of his red pickup truck. He had a red pickup truck forever. And we'd go down to the brickyard after priesthood meeting. You know, I was back in the days before the block where you had meetings in the morning and then a break and then meetings in the afternoon. We'd go down between the meetings to see how the brickyard was doing. And, I mean, it was a routine. We did it every Sunday. We'd always go down. And that Sunday, we went and climbed up in an area where they had hoppers that they would collect the clay to go into the grinding machines to make, you know, to prepare the clay to be made into brick. And those hoppers were loaded by an old overhead crane with a clamshell bucket. It is, you know, old industrial type stuff. That clamshell hadn't completely closed yet because it had a bucket full of clay, and it was just, nobody was there working. It was just sitting, waiting. And I, you know, looked at it and thought, wow, isn't that interesting? And I put my hand up to that clamshell, and it maybe had another 2-3 inches before it would be closed. Oh, my gosh. My dad unloaded on me. I mean, cuffed on the head, kicked in the butt, yelled at. I mean, as typical dad could do that sort of thing. Because if that had snapped shut at that moment, I'd have lost my hand. Which I didn't realize, you know, I was just young and didn't appreciate that. Well, boy, was Dad mad. And I thought he'd kill me before we got home. But, you know, he never punished me after that. But I realized, you know, I hadn't done a good thing. And Mac West, who you may not remember, Mac West was a superintendent at the brick plant. He and Dad went way back, and Mac worked for Dad. One day, after a particularly vigorous butt-chewing that we got from Dad down at his office in West Jordan, we were walking back up to the plant, and Mac turned to me, and he said, you know, Harv, your dad only yells at those he loves. And Mac wasn't a real educated guy, but he had pretty good insight into people. And I thought about it. I've never forgotten that moment, and realized that my dad, he really did. If he really cared, really cared about something, he could get pretty vigorous. And even though, you know, and immediately he'd forget about it. He did not carry grudges. He didn't, you know, lambast you again and again for the same old thing. But at the moment, you know, he would, if he cared, you knew about it. He was hardworking and a very forward-looking guy. You know, I think about the sacrifice he made to stay at the brick plant instead of taking his PhD in ceramic engineering from the University of Utah and going to Convair or Boeing and making a ton of money and, you know, being in the leading edge of ceramic engineering in the country. He stayed at the brick plant. Brick making is not exotic ceramics. Been around for thousands of years. He stayed and supported his dad and made that company go.
Well, we've got time. I want to ask you before the very end, just why you were a part of Interstate Brick and what it meant to you to get involved and what that heritage has been for you.
You know, in some ways, Dad and I, this is sort of bizarre, we're not that much different. I mean, I got a bachelor's degree in physics. You know, why in the world did I stick around at the brick plant? Well, we went back to the Naval Academy, and I taught physics there. And, you know, it just seemed like a natural thing to come back and work with my dad at the brick plant. And again, you know, maybe there could have been other things to do that were a little more exotic or lucrative. Yeah, lucrative would be a good word. But I felt, in the same sort of way, loyalty to that company, and to that industry that really has never really gone away. Even though I'm not involved in the brick industry now, I still have lots of memories, pleasant memories, and pride in, you know, it's something when you make a product that gets built into a building, and it's still there. You know, I mean, I can drive you around Salt Lake and name the brick on the buildings. You know, it's easy to do because you remember. I mean, you remember the problems and the good times and the bad times you had in making the brick for that building.
That's great. What would you like to say in conclusion?
Well, I tell you, it is disconcerting to me to be having this interview. And realize that many of the things that I remember doing with my dad, your grandpa, and your dad, Gary, are fading away. The old brickyard, you know, some of this stuff just isn't, you know, it's torn down, it's forgotten, and I can remember things that, they're gone. And it's bizarre to think that I'm in the same boat that my dad was, you know, as he got older. It just doesn't seem right. It also makes me deeply appreciate the efforts of all those who write histories and get events in the places of the past onto paper. My dad, Harold, was particularly good at this. He commissioned a book on the history of Interstate Brick in 1975. He did an oral history project with a professor down at BYU to collect memories about the brick company and get them on paper. And he's written much since then on his parents, and especially on the city where he retired, down in Washington City in Washington County in Utah.
Can I interject?
Sure.
And he had an opportunity in Nauvoo to teach the old way they did brick.
Right.
With Grandma.
Yeah, when he was on a mission there. That's right. I appreciate you, Jan, in getting us to come to StoryCorps and record some of what I remember. It's important. It's important that the past be documented, so that it does not die with those who lived it.
Well, I want to thank you for your time and sharing this with me. It's meant a lot to me to learn these things and to have them preserved for our family and other people. So
I'm
thank you, Uncle.
Glad to do it. You're welcome. Hopefully we did okay.